Who's the best show here?
The Loan Sling Tech Show is proudly sponsored by Open Country, providers of OCM, award-winning systems management software for the Linux Enterprise, and exclusive sponsors of the Webmin Project.
Does your computer crash? Are you aggravated with computer viruses and spyware? Are you looking for an alternative to Microsoft Vista? Whether you're an expert or have only just heard of Linux, here's your chance to learn more at the Southern California Linux Expo. You'll meet users of all skill levels and organizations who will show you what open source software can do for you at home or at work. The Expo has speakers who will discuss various hot topics in open source software, and this year we've even added beginner sessions to especially help those of you who are just starting out. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 10th and 11th, 2007, at the Westin Hotel at Los Angeles International Airport. For more information or to register, please visit www.socallinuxexpo.com. Use promo code CAST, C-A-S-T, for 40% off your registration. We'll see you there.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show! Tech Show! Tech Show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Wow, what an interesting startup for this show, huh?
Oh, this week has been one technical difficulty after another.
You think we never did this before, too, you know?
Oh, my God.
At least it's interesting.
Pat, you're going to have to turn yourself up.
That's what we call
it. We're talking to your microphone.
How about now? A little better?
Turn it up. How is it we can go from you being fine to you being horrible in the span of the intro?
I don't know. How about now?
Turn it up.
Must be my fault.
How about now?
No. Turn it down.
No, that's too much.
Holy mackerel. All right.
Sorry about that.
Let's introduce our wonderful guest tonight, Pat.
We got two fantastic guests. We've got Russ Pavlicek, a really smart guy who's written some really good books. He was on the Linux show, and he's been an advocate for Linux and open source software for a very long time. Russ, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
And we've got Peter Gutman, who is the author of a really interesting paper that a lot of people have been talking about the last couple weeks, a cost analysis of Windows Vista content protection. Coming in all the way from New Zealand, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
All right, so let's get rolling into a few things here. Peter, the internet, the interweb has been a buzz with your paper that you put out in, what was it, mid to beginning January, regarding the DRM and media restriction parameters that are in Windows Vista, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yep.
And...
Yeah, it was actually... Sorry.
Oh, what I wanted to do is, if you could just, like, give us a little idea of who Peter Gutman is and... a little synopsis of what your paper was about, what results you found, and then we can go from there and how that pertains to the Linux and open source community in general.
Okay, so my background is I've been working in computer security for pretty much forever. I helped work on PGP when it was still PGP 2.0, and since then I've been working on an open source crypto toolkit that's used by all sorts of organizations in various places around the world. And as a sideline, while I'm working on that or not working on that, I just look at various bits and pieces that might interest me in terms of computer security. And so one of the things that I noticed was that Vista had this huge bunch of, well, basically DRM technology built into it. And in my opinion, the engineering trade-offs they made were pretty bad. First of all, what they're trying to do is fundamentally impossible, in that you've got a very open platform like the PC, and they're trying to turn it into this very closed, locked-down platform, which is pretty much impossible to do without completely re-engineering the PC. And the side effect of that is, because they are trying to lock down the platform so much, you end up making some really, really bad engineering decisions. And so this came about. There was a discussion in private mail in late December with various people who had sort of noticed this and were talking about this and saying, you know, this is just really bad engineering. And I had some time over Christmas, so I did this write-up on my analysis of this purely from a security point of view. And for some reason, that seems to have grabbed people's attention and now it's ended up all over the internet.
So, I read your paper. I listened to you on Security Now. I've read Microsoft's response. I've listened to Microsoft's response. They're kind of, my opinion of their response was they took it kind of tongue-in-cheek and pretty much said, you know, that's the price of doing business. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah, that was the sort of we were only following was excused. But, you know, historically that hasn't been a very effective excuse. And I don't really buy that from Microsoft either. I mean, there was no reason for them to go to this level. You don't see other operating system manufacturers going out and saying, yeah, okay, in order to do business, we have to do all this as well. And in particular with Microsoft's response, I responded to that later on in my write-up. But a lot of what they're doing is, you know, you ask any software engineer or hardware engineer, and they will say this is really bad engineering, a really bad design. And so they've had to more or less defend the indefensible. So a lot of the stuff in their response has been sort of hand-waving and more PR spin than directly being able to technically respond to it.
So what implications do these have, these changes that Microsoft is making and pushing, have for other operating systems, particularly the, you know, Linux and BSDs?
Well, the nasty thing about this is that you can't really opt out. Because this requires significant changes in hardware and graphics cards and sound and device drivers and so on and so forth, you can't say, I'm running a non-Microsoft operating system, therefore it doesn't affect me. Because, you know, since Windows has, what, 90 to 95% of the market, all the vendors and all the manufacturers out there have to make these changes in order to still be compatible with Vista, in order to play in the Vista market. So even if you don't run Vista, you're still paying for the cost of these changes to the hardware that you're using to make them work with the Vista content protection.
Now, it's bad enough that we're going to be paying for this as part of the price of the hardware, but the bigger concern is whether or not will we be able to run this hardware on our Linux systems or our BSD systems?
I think the hardware should still run. I suspect strongly that you'll never be able to get your hands on premium content, though. Because the whole thing about this, a lot of this stuff is security through obscurity. If you look at things like the hardware functionality scan, so what happened is Microsoft were worried that someone would build effectively a hardware emulator or even a device driver emulating a particular piece of hardware. And so Vista feeds this precious premium content to the fake hardware or the emulated hardware, and that then just pulls it off the disk and records it in unprotected form. So in order to get around that, they required that drivers written by the vendors do something called HFS, hardware functionality scan, which exercises various bits of hardware functionality that would be hard to emulate. And the problem is, in order for that to work, you have to not publish the details of functionality they're emulating, or sorry, that they're exercising. And obviously not publishing hardware details makes it very hard to write open source drivers to support that particular hardware. So that's just one of the aspects of the ways that, you know, something designed for Vista is going to affect all other operating systems.
So what has the hardware manufacturer's response been to this, or has it been too early for them?
I've been pushing very hard to get any kind of response from hardware manufacturers. There's some very unsubtle hints in the write-up saying, you know, if any hardware manufacturers would like to comment, then please send me something. It's been impossible to get any word from anyone. I know some other people with various contacts into the industry have tried as well, and they've been unable to get anything either. I don't know whether that's simply because, you know, it's just in general it's hard to get that information, or whether there's some word come down in the hardware manufacturers saying don't make any public statements about this because we can't offend Microsoft. I don't know. The only public comment we've seen is one of the papers on Microsoft's website is from a guy who works for ATI, and he hasn't directly criticized Microsoft, but he certainly said repeatedly that it's causing a lot of pain for ATI and considerably extra expense. He says this again and again and again. Cost will be passed on to consumers. This will increase cost. This will increase cost. This will delay, you know, production of device drivers and so on, and all this will be passed on to consumers. So that's about the only criticism I've been able to find of this from the hardware manufacturer's point of view.
Yeah, I noticed in your paper a lot of the quotes in between the sections, a bunch of them came from somebody at ATI.
Yeah, that was the ATI guy. So he did a talk at, I think, WinHack, which is a Windows Hardware Engineering Conference, and he was presumably asked to give, you know, ATI's perspective on what effect this has. And the perspective wasn't very positive.
So is it possible then for a vendor to produce a piece of hardware that might have some kind of, for lack of a better word, Vista compatibility layer that allows for this content restriction at the same time still remaining accessible to other operating systems who don't implement or cannot implement those type of restrictions because that information is closed?
It's certainly possible. In theory, the problem is that, you know, at the moment it's already hard enough to get information and support out of vendors, particularly for sort of very detailed internal bits and pieces that they'd rather keep proprietary on their hardware. And so getting vendors to, you know, design something. If they design it specifically for Vista and they don't care about anything else, then that gets them, you know, 90, 95, whatever, into the market. If they have to go out of their way to design it to modify it for other operating systems, I don't know how much of an incentive there is for them to do that. I mean, certainly the easiest approach is to simply ignore the Vista-specific bit and just use the general purpose, but not specifically designed for content protection. But even then, you're still paying for it, you know, because you've got to include crypto hardware in your graphics card to encrypt the content going to the graphics card. The amount of the silicon taken up by the crypto hardware isn't being used for rendering engines or for rendering pipelines. So you're still paying for it no matter what. You can't just opt out entirely.
So given that you can't really opt out of it entirely, what about the other side of this? I mean, because I know, like, the community that we're in and the tech community in general seems to be really against what Microsoft has done. But what about the general community, Joe User? It seems like the message getting out to them is the hardest community to reach. I mean, is there efforts towards, you know, promoting this in the more general media?
I think the media interest, I'm actually not certain why there was such a huge amount of media interest in you know, what was a relatively obscure technical article. I think it was probably because of the upcoming release of Vista that the media were interested in it. I think the average user, after the initial fuss has died down, I think the average user probably will never know about it. I mean, they'll go out and buy a Dell PC preloaded with Vista, and they'll stick in a DVD and it won't play. But that's probably the most exposure they'll ever get to it. They won't see that, you know, hardware has become slightly more expensive because of adding all this, and device drivers are late and more buggy and so on. They won't really realize that. It's pretty much buried. And that's one of the nasty things about this, and I guess Microsoft is counting on this, is that so much of it is buried beneath the surface that unless you really look for it, you don't even know it's happening.
Now, Vista, if I'm not mistaken, Vista's already out now. It's been released.
Yep.
And what time frame are we seeing for? I mean, is it, I can't see that this is going to be going right from Vista's release from the gates, or maybe I'm wrong. But I mean, how much time do you see that we have before this really becomes a problem for Linux, BSD, and then for the community, in the general community, a general population, that they're going to start experiencing these limitations?
If you look at people running pre-release versions of Vista, or I've had reports from various people. I don't know where they got these things. Some of them seem to be running the release copy before it was released, and they're already running into problems like this, where they've got content that won't play, or there's something called Windows Protected Media Pipeline or something like that, which activates itself mysteriously when you're playing some types of content. We're still trying to find out exactly what that is. So they're already experiencing it. I've had some, so I haven't had any comments from device vendors in the sense of whether they like this or not, but I have had comments from developers, and they're saying that they're frantically rushing to get device drivers ready. A lot of the graphics drivers and sound drivers and so on needed for Vista never made it onto the RTM release to manufacturing DVDs. And so the first thing that happens when you install the thing is it'll go online and download vast amounts of extra device drivers that are, somewhat more recent than the ones that actually shipped with the Vista release. And I know from, talking to at least one device manufacturer, they were working on drivers pretty much until the last minute. And I don't know how much of that was content protection and how much of it was just generally, changes that have been made for Vista. But certainly the content protection was causing them a lot of pain to try and get that finished in time for the release date of Vista. So some informal estimates I've had, and, this is just a sort of an insider guess from people working on some of the drivers, is that it's going to be middle of the year before you get sort of fully stable, tested drivers that you can rely on. And presumably a lot of the content protection is also going to take a while because it requires hardware changes, it requires extensive device driver changes to support those hardware changes and so on. I think a more common experience at the moment will be people will stick in a DVD or an HD-DVD and it just won't play.
Wow. That's
Well, it's not that serious. Again, for the typical user who goes out and buys a preloaded Dell PC, they're not going to know about this. It may be, it may crash a bit more often than a standard XP install would, but in general, it's not really going to be noticeable.
Yeah, it's not going to be, because they're going to already have bought into the technology to be able to do that, and theoretically, they're going to have what they need to play those DVDs. HD DVDs, but when you get involved with other content like movies and music and stuff that you can purchase off, through online services, and talking about content limitation where you might only be able to play it one or two times, then you can't play it after that. I suspect for the general population, that's not going to be too much of a problem. But then I would assume that if Vista is going to implement this, Apple's going to have to follow in suit, too, and implement these restrictions.
It's very hard to guess, to try and second guess where Apple's going. If I were Apple, I'd do exactly the opposite. I'd say, we don't chain up your media and play the good guys. But it's really hard to know what strategy Apple's going to take in this.
But we're kind
the
of
other thing is, too, that Microsoft can afford to do this. I mean, they can afford to throw as many developers and as much money as they need onto this. I don't know whether Apple can afford to devote this vast amount of engineering. And Microsoft's been working on this for years. If you look back through this with the earlier stuff like Palladium, there are sort of remnants of Palladium in this content protection. So they've been working on this for at least 5 years. And I don't know if Apple or anyone else for that matter could say we're going to spend, I don't know how many $100 million, 5 years of effort to try and copy this Microsoft thing. The logical thing would be to sit back and see what happens to Microsoft. And if they get really badly bitten by it, then stay away from it.
What I think distresses me, personally, is, you know, for the longest time, it's been, I haven't been able to legally watch certain types of video or listen to certain types of audio using open source, free and open source software because of the closed codecs. And I wasn't, you know, not able to legally watch a DVD on my system, you know, a DVD that I would go out and purchase because libDVD CSS is not legal to run in the United States. And there isn't anybody out there really offering a free legal alternative to allow me to watch and play DVD. So now we have HD content coming down the pike, and once again, the FOSS community is going to be excluded from that, most likely, to be able to do it legally. And it seems like, you know, all in all, they're ultimately hurting certain sections of the population. Those who don't pay the Microsoft tax or essentially that to be able to watch legally purchased content.
Right. But then, you know, their motivation, I guess, and by they, I mean not necessarily Microsoft, but the content providers, is to make as much money as they possibly can. And again, because Microsoft covers most of the market, if they can make as much money as they can only on Microsoft platform, I suspect they don't really care whether there are people who can watch it or who can't.
Yep. So this adoption of this technology and the limitation of the hardware not only impacts the overall cost that a customer is going to have to pay for this, it's also going to really narrow choices again. And for those of us who would like to see more widespread adoption of free and open source systems, it's going to make it really tough for the general user. Even if technologically we get better at it, we get more appealing to the general user, there's still going to be, you know, that hurdle of legal hurdles that we're not going to be able to get over because of this new implementation of restrictions.
Well, it depends how much, you know, users are going to use PCs as media players. And, you know, I point that out at the end of the write-up. I can, for $50, I can get a DVD player that plays anything I want in pretty much any format I want. Why would I get a $1,000 PC to do that when I can get a $50 DVD player? So, you know, if being able to play back DVDs on a PC is the driving decision behind buying a PC, then I can see that, you know, that'd be a major thing for users. On the other hand, I suspect most users want to, you know, if they need to read email and organize their photos and who knows what else. So they may not even notice any problem with media, with playing back HD media.
Maybe. Right.
And even, you know, if you look at Windows, a major seller is Windows Media Center Edition. But that's sold because it's the cheapest, as far as I know, it's the cheapest version of Windows that you can pre-install on a PC. So it doesn't mean that there's this vast amount of demand for Windows Media Center Edition. It just means it's the cheapest copy of Windows you can get pre-installed. I don't know of any research where they've gone out and said, are you buying this PC to use as a DVD player specifically? So it depends how much demand there is for that particular use rather than just using it to get online.
Hey, Russ, have you been following this?
What a loaded question. I'll tell you, when I was looking at this paper, Peter, first off, I just want to say that great paper. Absolutely kick-ass paper. Because of my day job being as consuming as it is, I haven't been reading as much as I used to in the good old days. But looking at this, I immediately started thinking back to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act here in the U.S. And frankly, some of the pieces that I wrote for InfoWorld way back when are still floating around, kind of hitting me in the face once in a while. It's amazing to me how far we have come. And if I can just make a couple comments on some of the things that have been said so far. You know, I heard the phrase being used, legally purchased content. And, you know, you open source radical, you actually think you bought something. In the world of entertainment, copyrighted entertainment, you buy permission to revocable permission to be entertained at the whim of the provider. That's all you buy. You don't buy a damn thing, excuse the French, anymore. You know, we labor under the notion that, you know, if I paid money for a CD or a DVD, I should have some right inherently to use it. And if you listen to the rhetoric that's coming out of some of these copyright holders, it's exactly the opposite. All you're doing is getting this, you know, rather revocable permission to use it under circumstances which they dictate. It's almost like buying a hammer that's only useful for certain nails. And if you pick up a different package of nails, oh, no, no, you've got to go out and buy a different hammer, or else you violate your use restrictions on your hammer and you could be jailed. You know, I mean, that's the sort of ludicrous world that we're dealing with right now, frankly, from my perspective, in the whole entertainment sector. And I do have a solution, though. I really do. And I think it's finally time. It's been kicking around my head forever, but it was just so stupid that I couldn't even vocalize it. But now I'd say let's go for it. And that is, let's give the content providers precisely what they want. Let's give them full and total protection under the law. I think we should lobby to make sure that their content is entirely protected. Now, we have to realize what the ramifications of that are. We've got things like, you know, if you're selling music, we've got this horrible thing called radio, where people can, like, listen to music and record it without permission, and they listen to it without paying for it, and all sorts of horrible things. So the first thing we have to do is we have to ban music from radio. Then we've got this thing called a television, where people can actually watch movies and stuff like this, and sometimes they record them, and all sorts of horrible things. We should ban movies from television. In fact, all these discs that are floating around with all this copyrighted material, you know, this is just fodder for people who are pirates. And we know that all people are basically pirates. That's why we need DRM. So what we need to do is ban the sale of CDs and DVDs and all these things to protect the copyright holders, to protect their valuable intellectual property. And the great thing about this is that if we restrict movies to movie theaters and we restrict music to concerts so that you have to buy a ticket and go in and there's no way you can carry a copy out, within 6 months the entire entertainment industry will fall flat on its face and will beg for new terms. But I think, unfortunately, the rational way to go for us right now is to say, okay, you want to make everything illegal, let's make everything illegal, and we'll wait till we have to start over again. Because this is ridiculous. This is absolutely frickin' ridiculous what we're doing. And I think it was Peter mentioned Microsoft saying, you know, basically this is the cost of doing business. Well, I think what a lot of content providers have not figured on is that the freedom to be able to look and to listen without getting permission every time you load a disc into a particular machine is also part of the cost of doing business. If you're going to make money by selling music, then you have to be able to realize that someone who walks down the street humming your song is not stealing from you. You have to realize that part of the cost of doing business is that you have to make some things available for people to enjoy and not just assume that they're all frickin' criminals and we're going to nail their feet to the floor every time you turn around. And that, sir, is my sermon for the evening.
That was a pretty impressive sermon.
When do you think we're actually going to see a lawsuit that actually goes through the court system where the RIAA and MPAA are sued for racketeering, which is exactly what they're really doing?
Yeah. Oh, this is, you know, we have delved into the land of the lunatic, and I, you know, Peter, I don't know if it's your area. I'd love to hear if you know, New Zealand is as insane as the U.S. is currently with, you know, some of the laws protecting, supposedly protecting this valuable intellectual property. But, you know, we're rapidly going over the edge here in the U.S., I feel, and, you know, this is We're just going nuts. We are absolutely nuts right now.
I think what it boils down to is the record industry and the movie industry, you know, they've made this much money up to this point, and they still want to make that much money going into the next millennium, and the world has changed dramatically from the 20th century. They're still in the 20th century mindset of how to bleed consumers, you know, for the most bang for the buck. And it really has changed, and they probably realize that, but they don't want it to change, you know. If they can stop it, they will, for as long as possible.
Well, you know, you still have, you know, record industry executives who make these comments that basically still indicate that they believe that if you, you know, record a song off the radio, you're breaking the law. And, you know, last time I checked, at least in the U.S., the ability to record your own copy of something for personal use was still considered, you know, acceptable use. Why worry about the legalities and where the world is going when you're comfortable in the 18th century? You know, I think that's what it comes down to. It's interesting, by the way, I saw an interesting article the other day that indicates that apparently some of the record companies are feeling such a squeeze right now that some of them are now actually considering marketing songs through services that would actually sell unprotected MP3s. Apparently, one of the big areas potentially for that is China, because there's, I guess, so much pirating going on that they feel that they can't compete any other way. But it is interesting that, you know, at least some of these places are starting to understand that maybe the world isn't exactly the way they want it to be. Now, where that comes out, I have no idea.
So, Peter, any comments about the situation in New Zealand?
It's slightly different. With the problem with not just New Zealand, but I know with other countries as well, Australia got hit with this quite badly, is because a lot of the world's media and content is produced in the US, or at least it's effectively owned by US companies. There's an immense amount of pressure coming from there for other countries to adopt DMCA-type legislation. And I know Australia is part of their trade deal with the US. Were pretty much forced to adopt this rather nasty DMCA type legislation. There have been some attempts to do it over here. In fact, there's one that's just happening right now. There's a workshop next week in which various people are discussing comments on that, where they're introducing more and more DMCA type restriction. It's not quite as bad as the US yet. I guess another reason is that the media companies aren't that big or that powerful over here. So they don't, you know, they're not going around suing people doing file sharing or anything like that, because both the media companies aren't big enough, and probably because the amount of criticism they get if they did that would make them think twice about doing it. But certainly there are attempts to introduce DMCA type stuff over here as well.
Huh.
But one of the weird things I've noticed when reading through the proposed legislation is that it talks about rights, and all the rights seem to be the rights of the content owners. It doesn't really say anything, you know, when it says protection of rights. It doesn't say anything about protection of consumer rights. It's only talking about the rights of the content owners. And there are very few exceptions sort of grudgingly granted to consumers. But the content owners have all the rights, which, you know, I guess maybe purely from a New Zealand perspective seems rather strange to me, because the point of legislation is, you know, you've got traffic safety legislation to protect the public, and what this legislation seems to be doing is protecting business interests, and it's certainly not protecting the public much.
And by content owners, you're talking about the media conglomerates, and you're not talking about
right. The
producers and the actors and everything, because their rights are kind of slim, too.
No, it's media conglomerate.
Well, I don't know. I hope something breaks soon. I mean,
we're fighting it, so I don't know what the final you know, revised legislation will look like. But there's certainly a lot of people who are pointing out all sorts of problems with it. New Zealand does have one, I don't know if it's unusual, but it's a sort of thing enshrined in law where allowing parallel importation of things like consumer goods. And that's why we don't have region-locked DVD players, because there is legal protection for the import of DVD players from anywhere in the world. And because they're from regions other than ones that are locked to New Zealand and Australia, they tend to be universally region-free. I don't know if it's even possible to still buy region-locked DVD players over here. And that's why I made the comment, again, at the end of the write-up, that I'll wait a year or two and then buy some $50 Chinese made player that'll play back anything you want. And, you know, by the same token, the Asian made players, they'll play back DivX and Exit and everything else as, alongside the obvious DVD. So pretty much anything you stick in there, they'll play back, and they don't really care what it is or where it's from.
So they're going to spend all this time and all this money implementing this technology to restrict people from being able to steal premium content. In your opinion, how soon until that, you know, they implement this technology to do it, until it's actually broken and the people who really, you know, make it really make an impact on the industry by piracy are going to just, you know, continue business as usual?
Well, I think the professional pirate, it was broken, you know, 10 minutes after it was released. I mean, they have professional gear. They have access to hardware and whatnot. For the professional pirates, it makes no difference whatsoever. And you can get, and again, I was going to mention this in the write-up, so-called DVI amplifiers, which are basically just chips with HTCP encryption built in. And they input an encrypted signal and they output an unencrypted signal. You can actually buy them commercially in some places, but they've sort of gone underground because of pressure on them from you know, content owners. And that's what the commercial pirates are going to be using. They'll just get hardware to do the decryption and you know, pull out the plain text signal. They'll get commercial video mastering gear that doesn't use encrypted signaling, whatever, and they'll pirate it that way. But even the small guys, I mean, there's that guy, Muslik64, who broke the ASES security on both HD-DVD and Blu-ray disc. And he said it took him about a week to do. And that, you know, HD-DVD is basically broken, and there's no easy way to fix it. One of you mentioned earlier the fact that you can revoke access to the content. So, in theory, this sounds like, you know, really bad for consumers. But it's also pretty much, you know, a way for the media, or the content owners, to shoot themselves in the foot. Because what the people breaking the security can do is they can re-break it and re-break it and release new keys that they've extracted out of the player, say, once a week, which means the content owners or Microsoft or somebody has to revoke all the existing players once a week and reissue them. They want about once a week player stuff. Yeah, it's something, you know, I used an analogy, but it's sort of like chess playing where they've looked one move ahead and they've said, we can revoke these things. But they haven't looked at what happens after you've revoked them, you know, the consumer backlash when suddenly your players stop working. And more importantly, the fact that the attackers can force you to revoke your players continuously as often as they want. So you've got the users at the mercy of the content owners, but you've also got the content owners at the mercy of the pirates.
It's an ugly situation.
It's a completely screwed up situation.
It's only getting worse, it looks like.
Hey, maybe one day it's going to get so bad that it'll just turn around. I mean, I read a post on Dig today that there was a 17-year-old, is it 17 now? Kid suing the RIAA for defamation of character. And, you know, the personal pain he felt and his family for being slandered as a pirate and taking the trial. And I guess his mom was taking the trial too. So, you know, hopefully he'll get something out of that.
I think, that may stop them suing, you know, 12-year-old kids and grandmothers and so on. But I don't think it'll stop them wanting to do the impossible, which is, you know, protect content in a way that you basically can't do.
Now, you know, speaking of all this restriction, what I find interesting is right before the holidays, there was rumors flying around that Amazon was going to start releasing a music service that provided DRM-free content. And, you know, that was kind of exciting. And then we come out of the holidays, and now we got your paper on Vista. It seems like, I don't know, which direction are we going here? I mean,
I really can't tell it. I can't. I'm not much good at predicting the future.
Yeah, I think this comes down to a follow the money issue. Quite honestly, that what we're looking at. You've got these, as someone pointed out, these content owners who you know, are firmly entrenched somewhere around the 14th century in terms of their content concepts, and. And so they believe that anyone who, you know, sings happy birthday to you is, you know, a pirate. But by the same token, the motivating factor there is money. So if the money stops coming their way as they, you know, choke the throat harder and harder, I think that they're going to reconsider. And I think that's what's going on with some of the music companies, because they're beginning to realize that they're trying to lock down their content and bleed every penny out of every song, but the bottom line is they're actually making less money than they were when they weren't trying so hard. And if that trend can actually continue, you may see some reversal of fortune.
One other comment I want to make about your paper, Peter, is after I came away from reading your paper and some of the other comments and everything, I got the impression that it's going to be a lot harder to play different types of premium media on a Windows system than it is going to be to secure, a lot harder to play that than it is to secure a Windows system from getting, you know, viruses or spyware on it. And that sounds kind of backwards.
Right. Well, that was, I mean, that was, again, from the engineering point of view, that was one of the things that kind of upset me, that they've put this huge amount of work into the content protection when they should have put it into, you know, protecting against spyware. One of the examples of what they do is that they implement encrypted paging, but only for premium content. So they'll quite happily page out your banking password or your credit card number or whatever to disk unencrypted. But if you get one single frame of protected content, they will encrypt it before they page it out to disk. And that's just completely backward.
I don't know. Shameful. Pat, you got a comment there?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, as a Linux user, I couldn't care less about Windows. It's the vast majority of users out there, and, you know, most people, you know, are clueless when it comes to their computers. They tend to think of the computers as toasters, and not as a very powerful tool that we know it is. And, you know, honestly, I couldn't care about them, but it does affect, you know, the possibility of affecting us is pretty high, and that's where my concern is.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We will have to see. Peter, I want to thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about your research and your findings and how they would apply to our community. It was a fantastic job, and we've been recommending that our listeners read your paper, listen to the shows you've been on for the past week or so. You're more than willing to stay on as long as you want. We're probably going to move on to some other topics, but I want to thank you for taking your time out again.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
And, you know, we did some introductions briefly, but we didn't really let Russ provide a proper introduction to actually who is Russ Pavlochek. Who is this man called Russ that we've heard so much from and then heard so
the
little
legend.
From? And now we get to hear more from him again.
Oh, God.
Well, you write a couple of books, right, Russ? And a whole bunch of articles
for
the magazines?
Yeah, I've been all over the place. I started out as a child. I guess one of the most influential things on me from a technical standpoint was spending 14 years at mostly DEC and then Compaq, after Compaq, 8DEC. But it was during that time that I ran into what was going on in the whole Linux world, and that was in 95. And by 97, I became thoroughly convinced that this was more than just, you know, geek toy time. This was something that was going to make a huge wave in the whole technology field. And just something that might be of interest to some folks is that, for me, the big turning point was the first Atlanta Linux showcase in 1997. I don't know if anyone actually remembers that anymore, except for a few tremendously old goats like me.
Dave Yates.
But it was one of those things where you had 500 geeks in Atlanta on a weekend, 98% male. You had Linus Torvalds giving the keynote address, which was called something like, I think, World Domination 101 or something like this. And it was the most amazing thing to me, because it became abundantly clear that not only was, you know, the technology coming along by leaps and bounds and wonderful things were being done, but there was no natural plateau in sight for what was going on. And that kind of woke me up big time, that that there was something coming here that was more than just, you know, some sort of fad or you know, geek toy, like I said before, but this was going to be huge. And I started sort of preaching this in digital at the time. And there was a very small group up in the Northeast who were doing alpha support for Linux. And so, you know, the first 64-bit Linux implementation was on the alpha. And so you had this little handful of engineers up in, I think it was Nashua and Merrimack and that stuff. You had Mad Dog Hall, who was traipsing around inside the sort of the traditional Unix horns. And I was shooting my mouth off in the field. And, you know, you kind of felt like the prophet in the wilderness, I guess. And when Compaq ate digital, and then Compaq decided that they didn't need a lot of us, and I was one of the guys who got laid off, the then editor of InfoWorld came to me and asked if I would start writing a column for them, because Nick Petrelli had moved on to Computer World, and so they wanted someone who could talk about open source. And I wrote that for a couple of years, and that was one of the most cathartic things in my life, quite frankly, because after being ignored so soundly for, you know, 4 years, yelling and screaming about Linux, actually having people listening to what I was saying and at least arguing with me, if not actually paying some heed, was very gratifying to me. I did that. I was a columnist for Processor magazine after that. I did write a book in 2000, earlier than all this, when I was still at DEC, called Embracing Insanity, Open Source Software Development. And true to most technical books that are over 5 years old, you can buy it on Amazon, last I checked, where the postage actually costs more than the book does. You know, what the hell. But so I've kind of traipsed around a bit writing, and then caught on with Cassatt Corporation 3 years ago. And we're doing agile infrastructure stuff that is really incredible, quite frankly, sitting on top of a Linux platform, but allowing people to divorce the concept of content on your machines from the physical machine. We kind of go one step further than the virtualization that, you know, VMware and Xen does. We actually manage the whole mess, so that we'll manage your VMs, manage the hardware and all that stuff together. So it's truly neat stuff, but it's tremendously tiring to have to deal with all this. So, and then, of course, all mixed in there was the Linux show.
Which we all miss very much.
And myself included. That was a great great deal of fun. Jeff Gerhardt and Kevin Hill and Arnie and some of the others, Doc Searles, and there were some guys before I was around there. But we went. Jeff, I think, had it going 7 years up until the point of our hiatus, which is still ongoing in the close of 2004. I've had some communication with Jeff, and as far as he's concerned, it ain't over yet. He almost had things back together again when someone else stuck a pin in things, but after what he went through the first time, he had to build up an entirely new structure for the show legally, because unfortunately he was responsible for anything that went on, and during that last year we had things like unasked for bills from unions when we stretched out and did one of the Linux World shows and did all this live broadcasting, which was a great hoot, but it just trashed him financially in a lot of ways. Certain other things went on that it was just really rough on him. So
You guys were doing that show before there were podcasts and services like Libsyn and other options where hosting's fairly cheap. You guys basically did it before anybody else did it.
Yeah, I was when it first began, I was a listener, not a participant. But the it's amazing to think back that Jeff and Kevin had the concept of going on with this the way they did. And at a time too, if some people may remember that there was a period in about 1999, give or take, when just about all the then extant Linux media outlets had some sort of radio, quote unquote, that they were trying to do. And Flash.org had one, and Linux Today had something or other, I think, at the time, and a number of others floating around out there. But the fact that Jeff kept going, it meant a hell of a lot to a lot of people. And one of the things I do appreciate about your program, and even hearing before the stream started, some of the difficulties tonight of getting the Astra server and all the other pieces to come together properly, even though you've done this for years, doing this sort of thing on a weekly basis is hard work. I mean, it can be a great deal of fun, but man, it is hard work. You need to have dedication. You need to realize that there's going to be a cost to you, to your family time and everything else, because you got to keep sectioning off, this part of the week to get stuff done, and there's real monetary cost to it all and so forth. And I applaud you fellows for doing what you're doing. I definitely applaud Jeff for all the work that he put into the TLS and the fact that he still wants to bring it all back again. But it's a hard thing.
Yeah, I really hope that he has success in bringing it back, because right before you guys went off, you were really starting to take off with you were going to do the Linux Daily and getting more technology put into place to help improve the show overall, and man, then it just fell out, and that was a bummer.
Yeah, it was really rough, because we were starting to stretch and do some interesting things and to get kind of slapped in a lot of ways the way we were. It hurt, but the thing is, the really interesting thing is that Jeff has got his series of plans, and I'm not going to go into any details there. I'll let him, you know, work it out in his time. But I mean, he's always been very serious about TLS, and he still is. And he's trying to put together something that could be even more interesting long term. So stay tuned, folks. Don't give up. Anyone out there who actually might have been a listener of ours once upon a time.
Let me ask you a question. And since you were on the inside of TLS, and you know you've been on the inside, you've seen what's come after TLS. Right at the end of TLS was when that came to the hiatus. That's when it seemed like podcasting really started to take off. And, mm-hmm. you know, our show and a lot of the other Linux shows that are put together are pretty much done on a shoestring budget. And, you know, you take the technology that you have and you make the best use you can out of it and cross your fingers and hope everything goes well. It really sounded like that Jeff was attempting to not only, you know, use the technology, but also do it on a professional level and throwing a lot of money into it to put out a really polished product, which, you know, a lot of podcasts don't necessarily have that kind of polish. Do you see a difference between what you guys were doing and what is going on today with a lot of this podcasting phenomena?
It's kind of difficult for me to comment because, quite frankly, in a lot of ways, I don't deal with a lot of the podcasts that are floating around. And that's not because of sour grapes or anything else. Quite frankly, I mentioned before we went on the air that boredom and I are not on speaking terms. That's just my life, for better or for worse. So, quite frankly, I don't have time. You know, I think the nature of technology, the nature of the business that we're in, is that everything always moves. It always changes. And you have to keep adjusting and keep rethinking. And if you get set in your ways, and, you know, this is harkens back to this whole, music and video rights holders discussion. If you get set in your ways, you get left behind, and it's just the fact of life with technology. It is, geez, I mean, this is one of the scariest professions that anyone can ever be in, as far as I'm concerned. If you think about it, you know, 100 years ago, a guy growing up on a farm or where have you, or in a factory town, you know, he learned skills from, you know, his father or whatever, or he apprenticed under someone in the village, in the town, and they learned a skill, and that was the skill set basically that you had for your lifetime. You spent your life sort of perfecting that skill set, being a cobbler or a farmer or whatever it was. We live in an industry, in a day and time, where if you're in the technology sector, your skill set is obsolete every 5 years. You know, you have to stop, not only relearn a whole bunch of new stuff, but rethink it. You know, I mean, I stopped doing serious coding, frankly, when a lot of the object-oriented stuff came around, for the simple reason that, conceptually, I liked what was going on, but from a practical standpoint, I didn't like the structure of it. And you kind of find yourself, if you don't make those jumps, you just got to let things go and pick up something else that's different. It's a weird, weird world where you're basically reinventing yourself, over the course of your professional lifetime. You may have to reinvent yourself 10 times.
Isn't that the truth? And you still got another 10 or 15 times ahead of you, at least, don't you?
Do we lose him?
I don't know. We shouldn't have lost anybody. Russ, you still there?
Sounds like he might have dropped off.
How'd that happen?
The mystery of light.
It's just evil tonight.
Bummer. The planets are aligned against us.
What the hell? Everything was going fine.
Well, that's a stinky thing.
Well, you got to express your stinky opinion a little closer to the microphone.
My face is right on the microphone. I just have no voice with which to express it.
Cigars would help.
Cigars.
That really
just smoke out the virus.
Yeah, but you know what? If he dropped off, how come we didn't hear the drop off?
I do not know. Maybe it was the phone on his end. We don't know. You know.
Yeah, but usually it cuts out. You hear the dude. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What the heck?
The tube.
Anything is possible. Tonight.
But anyway, I wanted to mention, even though, you know, Russ isn't on here, perhaps he'll listen to it. I've been wanting to get Russ on the show for a very long time. He's one of my my favorite Linux commentators, I guess, so to speak. And I really hope that he will consider coming on the show a lot more often.
That'd be really cool. I appreciate that.
Oh, did you drop off?
No, I don't know what happened there. I mean, I actually was talking, and the next thing I know is, like, no one's hearing me. Or something. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Show it to VoIP.
Dan messing with volume controls again.
I'm not touching anything. Yet. Yet. Yet.
Russ, what are you doing these days on a day-to-day basis?
Well, like I mentioned, you know, I'm actually over the decade that I was spent at DEC and Compaq, I was inside professional services for them, kind of where the rubber meets the road, getting stuff done. And I had this opportunity come up actually at a Linux World to join Thought Corporation back 3 years ago, and I've been there ever since. And I'm doing professional services for them too on the East Coast. So, you know, it's neat stuff, and working a lot on Linux platforms and so forth, and I'm just chugging along. It's actually a lot of interesting technology, but, you know, as with any young company and so forth, they keep you really, really busy. So you get tired, but what the hell? And then, of course, my personal life is no less busy because, you know, I've got two kids who have just moved out to Western Maryland and actually bought houses within a mile of each other. And both of them are, you know, refurbing, so I'm spending my good portion of my weekends out there learning to be a plumber and electrician, which I'm getting all too familiar with at this point. So, and my daughter's getting married.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
My son is expecting his first child in like 3 months, and so, you know, we're busy.
Congratulations.
Very busy.
Yeah, so, yeah, this is going to be a big year. I don't think I have enough vacation this year. That's going to be the biggest problem.
So how... You've been in the community for a very long time, and so what's your impression now of how things are going with Linux and the adoption of Linux, not necessarily in the enterprise markets, but also in the general user population?
Well, it's very interesting in a lot of ways. I had, dating back to, my InfoWorld days, I had my own little group of antagonists that would write me from time to time, and I'd try to say, "Oh, this isn't going anywhere, you know, Windows is it, da 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 da." And there was one fellow way back when who took issue with me when I said, you know, I think the Linux desktop is finally about to arrive. I forget exactly how I put it. But I was saying at the time that within, I forget what it was, like 3 years, we'd see more of it. Well, of course, on the anniversary of that statement, he writes me an email saying, "I don't see it. I don't see it. It's not here. You're wrong." And you know, I think I may have written back something that said, you know, basically, well, my timing's a little bit off. I still think it's coming. And like a year later, he did it again. So it's been a whole nother year. It's still not here. You're wrong. And but at that point, I realized something else, which I wrote back to him. It's not coming the way I expected it to, but it's definitely coming. I mean, one of the interesting things working with the company I work with is that you deal with a lot of, you know, Fortune 100 type companies, and Linux is you know, it's been very strong in the server area for years in business. But the thing that's kind of not as well known, I think, is how strong it's getting to be on the desktop in certain industries. You know, I think it's natural to focus on Linux as a personal desktop. You know, when's that going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And that's all valid. But it's interesting to me that at least in the continental U.S., I think that the adoption on the business desktop is going to be the one that we're going to see first in the desktop world. And it will be unheralded, largely, because, quite frankly, the companies that are starting to do this are realizing they don't want to talk about it because their competition, why tell the competition their good ideas? And so they're keeping quiet. But it's definitely happening. It's still a minority position, but it's not a trivial position anymore, and it used to be very trivial, desktop Linux in business a couple of years back. But it is definitely out there, and it's gaining momentum very quietly, very slowly. Desktop Linux, I think, for the home user, I think is going to be the type of thing that we definitely will see in other than U.S. markets growing more drastically. I think that's already beginning to happen inside certain areas. I think it was Mad Dog Hall who likes to point out that you know, you still have a vast majority of the world who have yet to pick their operating system. You know, those of us who live in the U.S., particularly North America in general and so forth, and also, you know, like New Zealand and Australia and so forth, you got a lot of technical people that have made their choice, and you know, there are entrenched powers in Windows and so forth. But you have these huge masses in China and Africa and other parts of Asia and so forth, which haven't joined the technological world, or only are just beginning to do so in the types of numbers that they have, and they're still making their choice. And if anyone goes to the Linux World, and I know a lot of the guys here on the panel have been to the Linux World Expos, you really have to be impressed by the fact that there's a lot of work for Chinese Linux, particularly, out there. That is definitely an interesting thing, interesting area of growth. So I think that you know, the way in which Linux becomes more and more prevalent is going to be a little bit more reverse than what some of us had thought 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, I remember a lot of those conversations you guys had on the Linux show, and it was, you know, a lot of times you guys would be like, yeah, the tipping point is coming, and, you know, it was just over the horizon, it seemed, all the time.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, there is a game going on, and, you know, you see it very much, too, with the whole Vista thing and the DRM thing, and it has to do with trying to lock the consumer into a particular track, and there are some companies who historically are very good about that, They know how to play the game, and they make a lot of money at it, particularly a company in Redmond, Washington, I can think of. And, you know, those are very hard cards to draw against. It's a difficult to beat companies that can do that well at their own game. So really, I think the way in which you end up winning is to change the rules. And that's where I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on overseas is going to be the most interesting areas where, you know, particularly there are countries out there where being a, getting things out of America is not necessarily a benefit. You know, there is suspicion and so forth. And so, you know, the power of Microsoft and some of these other vendors is muted because there is no established hierarchy there. There is no overwhelming need to stay with the entrenched leader the way it is over here. And there's no need to, you know, buy American, you know, if you're in Thailand or whatever. So so it'll be very interesting to see how all of that develops. Plus, you know, the old saw that the best and brightest love to dissect things. They love to understand how things work. It means that there is a natural tendency for the best and brightest, wherever they are in the world, to pick up open source software and learn from it. You know, if you're in Ethiopia and you're trying to learn how to program, you're going to pick up, if you can, a piece of programming to learn from that you consider good, and more than likely that's going to be something where the code, you know, code's got to be available. Hell, open source. And if you're learning for open source, then chances are you're going to deal with open source because it's going to become home for you. And so I think that's where it's going to get very, very interesting. The question in my mind really is over the next 10 years or so, will the American software industry and the American technology focus try to turn itself into like the music companies and the movie companies where they take their strong position and say, we will not move. You know, we will hold our ground and, you know, we will be victorious. Because frankly, I don't think we can do that and succeed. We may be able to succeed at home for a while, but I think in the long term, that's not the way to go. You've got to be able to deal with something, beyond your own, shores. And whether or not we're going to pull that off, I don't know. So this is going to be an interesting thing to watch. No, Linux is not about to go away regardless of what some people who have sent me email over the years might want to believe.
So what are your thoughts then? A couple months back, Eric Raymond proposed that in order for Linux to be more appealing to the masses, has to begin to support some closed source applications and audio codecs and stuff, because people just want to, you know, be able to use their computer the way they want to out of the box, would want a Linux system out of the box. And so what are your opinions on that, and with the release of the Windows codecs to support closed multimedia formats?
You know, this is it's a real difficult issue, quite frankly. And I understand the point that's being made. Absolutely, that you've got, as someone pointed out, you've got people who are looking for appliances. They're looking for a toaster, a PC that will, you know, play my MP3s or whatever it is, or my WMAs or what have you, and allow me to do these other things I want to do. And it's all well and good. And somehow we have to address it. Now, I do believe that it's possible to do it in a layered sense. I think it has to be thought out very carefully. I don't think that, I'm not the, I'm not Richard Stallman, you know, I mean, in terms of believing that every single piece of code that's ever written should be available to everyone. But by the same token, I do believe that it makes far more sense for most pieces of code to be in that category than not. I actually do like the model of companies that do things, you know, do some development closed and then start opening it up as a way for them to sort of initially recoup some of their investment and then build market share by opening up the code, allow it to be open source, and so forth. Now, in the case of these codecs, the whole thing's a lot trickier. But I think we have to have some way to grant people the opportunity to get their toaster. Exactly what that line is, I'm not exactly sure myself at this point. But I think it's a point to wrestle with for sure. I may sound like a total cop out, but it's quite frankly, I'm not sure of what exactly the answer is yet. I had to think about this for a long time. It is not, it's not a simple game. Anyone who's ever, especially some of us who used to have to wing your way through a Linux install, you know, loading Slackware floppies or whatever the heck it was, you remember probably pretty distinctly the pain of trying to get certain pieces of hardware to work, and maybe the pain of discovering that a piece of hardware you have won't work. Those are the sorts of things that can drive sort of a populist adoption of Linux away. Now the question is, do you adopt the closed codec, or is it possible to somehow give people a truly open alternative that can be adopted inside some other way? Somehow you have to change someone's mind to get them to take the open codec. And that's kind of the trick through all this. That is not a question, I think, of engineering as much as it's a question of social engineering, as it were, being able to somehow reach the minds and hearts of both people and content providers that there is something better. And better, unfortunately, changes according to who you're talking to. In the case of these copyright holders and so forth, better somehow has to amount to dollars. Kind of sad but true. You have to show them that there is a happy path here where they will make the money that they want to make and still be able to buy. So it's the trick. I think it's the trick that's always been associated with open source business, quite frankly. Linux distributions have wrestled with this for years. You know, how do you put all these things together? How do you find, from a business standpoint, the right balance between openness and the ability to make a buck off of your labor? I still don't think that book is even a quarter written. I think we're going to see more in that area in the next decade, easily.
Speaking of, back in the heydays of Slackware floppies, I mean, I think that the installation process of Linux has come a phenomenal distance. I mean, it's like almost brain dead easy to get something like Ubuntu on a PC nowadays.
That's absolutely correct, and I think about that every time I put Linux on a laptop I've never seen before. Laptops used to be hell. It was bad enough in the old days when you were just trying to put it on a 386, for God's sakes. But for the longest time, laptops were absolute hell. Trying to get the either the video driver or the sound or both to work was the type of thing that you could sink a couple weeks into easily. And, you know, much to my total pleasure, it's pretty darn rare when I run into something that doesn't have a relatively simple solution to it. I think one of the big things when Nopix started doing its, you know, installless live CDs, and that darn thing just seemed to be able to recognize just about everything.
Wow, this is great news, Eddie Z.
Out there, that was absolutely tremendous, and I think that frankly raised the bar for a lot of the then standard distributions to say, hey, you know, these people can do it without taking a frickin' breath. Let's beef ours up. And I think a lot of installation programs actually got a whole lot more robust in the year or two after Nopix's birth, because they just did such a phenomenal job of recognizing hardware and self-configuring.
Yeah, if only we can get the wireless card manufacturers to play a little nicer.
Oh, yeah, that truly sucks. you know, you still have to pick your wireless cards with great care. One of the things that actually I'm finding refreshing, I don't know whether other people are seeing it as well, but I'm having less and less issues with other things like digital cameras and whatnot. I think there's some standardization there, and GPhoto 2 and all those have done pretty well. And then, of course, there are a lot of things now that are just kind of falling into the USB-ish model so that you don't need goofy-ass drivers to get things done, which is really neat. That's the type of standardization that I think we can use a whole lot more of in hardware. You know, I'd love to hear what people's impressions are of printers these days, because I don't deal with them that often. I mean, you know, I've got the ones I use and so forth, but I don't tend to go through a whole bunch of them, at least as much as I used to. And you know, for a long time, printers were a real pain in the butt. And you know, from what I'm seeing, it looks like things are improving, but I'd love to get people's feedback on that subject sometime.
You know, I will admit that my printer usage has been a little limited, but the past couple of years I have not had any problems with connecting printers up to a Linux system. In fact, I've had some USB printers that you plug them in and they're pretty much recognized right out of the box and almost good to go in cups or going through something like KDE's print manager to set those up. And, you know, setting up network printers, the most difficult thing I've found is, you know, just finding the address for it. And it pretty much has been pretty good to go with getting itself set up. It's come a long way, too, you know, compared to some other stuff. Some of the newest printers out there or the cheap printers may be some difficulty. But since I've been sticking with laser printers, it's been really easy.
Yeah, the best thing I did is I went to a computer show and picked up a used HP 4M with an HP JetDirect card for $25, and it works fantastic.
Terrific. And I know the HP driver support's been really, really good. I don't know about some of the other, you know, like Lexmark used to be incredibly problematic.
They're cheapy printers.
They were hellish if you didn't run a certain distribution that came with the binary. I think they had some kind of binary driver out there, an RPM format that you could pull down.
Right, the Red Hat.
Yeah. I think the last one I set up was for my dad about a year and a half ago, and it was easier just plugging this thing into Ubuntu and having it all ready to go than it was, you know, putting it onto a Windows 2000 system. Which was the other
system
we had.
You really know what you're getting into with those kind of printers if the printer is cheaper than the ink cartridges.
Yeah, you buy extra printers just so you can get more ink. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about that, though, you know, harkening back to the discussion on Vista for a second, I think it's one of the hallmarks of the Microsoft way, quite frankly. Not to pick on Microsoft, but why the hell not? Is that, you know, some of the discussion about the new drivers and the struggle to get the drivers up to date and so forth, and, you know, the resulting bugs in Windows, you know, bugs in Windows, who knew? But the whole notion, though, that there's this ready-made excuse with all of this VRM stuff.
Feature.
The problem is the driver provided by your hardware manufacturer isn't good. You know, yeah, you're having a Windows problem. No, it's not a Windows problem. It's because your hardware manufacturer wrote a bad driver. Go complain to them. You know, it's the same sort of nonsense that's gone on for years historically, this deflection of blame that's gone on in the virus area. You know, it's like, oh, you got infected with a virus? Well, what did you do wrong? You didn't update your third-party virus checker software? Oh, my God, you are so irresponsible. You know, instead of saying, listen, you know, this is a flaw in the product. You know, this is something that the manufacturer should be held feet to the fire on. But no, you know, there is this deflection. And, you know, we've kind of given birth to this almost masochistic tendency in IT to believe that when something goes wrong, it can't possibly be Microsoft's fault. You know, it must be that, you know, you didn't update your virus software. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. What's wrong with you? Oh, you read your email? How dare you read your email? You're supposed to be scanning it first. Well, maybe if you write an email program that doesn't suck, you won't have to deal with that. But, you know, what the hell?
It's too obvious.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the hiding in plain sight. And, you know, the whole thing that, DRM will introduce more bugs into Windows, but quite frankly, who will notice? You expect to find bugs in Windows anyway. It's amazing. It's sheer talent to be able to do what they do, I think.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the cameras and scanners, I mean, I agree with you. Those things have come a long way. I remember having to mess around with having to edit SANE files and doing other things to get your camera working. And now you just plug it in, and it's like, do you want to, you know, rip your pictures off of your camera there with, well, you know, what application do you want to use? Or, you know, it pulls up SANE or whatever your application, your scanner front end is, and it's good to go. I mean, it's brain dead easy.
Yeah. And then you've got certain distributions like, I'm very fond of Zandros for end user stuff. If you're not a geek, you want your Linux-based hoster. Zandros has done a very nice job, I think, of putting together a desktop that addresses that. Actually, both of my kids use Zandros. My wife uses Zandros. And one of the nice things, you know, you plug things in and things just sort of pop up like, here I am. What do you want to do? And that's what you need inside the toaster world. And it's also darn nice for those of us who are looking for a little bit more than a toaster that it still happens. But, you know.
Yeah.
Just as long as you don't run an Apple, I'm happy. You got that whole iPod generation, you know?
Yeah.
How do you know he doesn't have an iPod? Do you have an iPod, Russ?
Nope.
Good for you.
Nope. I think I have, you know, a Chinese-built MP3 player that, anything that I pull off of one of my totally legal CDs, to carry with me on trips and whatnot. I just pop on there, little USB device, what the hell. No, I'm not big on iPodding, Q-podding, knee-podding, knee-podding, or anything else.
Does it play OG?
Excuse me?
Does your player, does it do OG?
Actually, I think the one that I have here doesn't. Although I think the one that my daughter has does. I'd have to double check that.
That's good. My wife just bought an iAudio, and that does OG. We're excited.
Which one did you get?
Which one? The U3. It does OG, MPEG-4, and XVID format. So, looking forward to that coming. Looking forward.
About time.
Hopefully a lot more support for open formats will come down the pike. I think, you know, I'd like to see more open formats. I think what needs concentration on is the formats are great, just the applications to export into open formats need a little work.
Mm.
Not just on the Linux side. I think on the other, QuickTime. What's the quick apples? You know, they're just the commercial products too, having more capabilities of exporting in the closed or open format as just opposed to closed would be beneficial. Although that seems like
right. It
might be difficult to convince the companies to do that.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the time it's a question of finding the spot, the sweet spot, the spot where they can make money by doing it. You know, one of the things that may sound a little bit off compared to where we're talking about, but I think it kind of fits. You know, for years, I've seen the VMware stuff that's out there, you know, for virtual machines. The technology is essentially pretty old. I mean, I used to play with Box a whole lot. People who remember that, which is one of the most fun ways of taking your 386 and making it work like less than an XT in the old days. But being able to do this virtualization, and then suddenly, at least it seemed to me, about 18 months ago, the entire IT industry, and you saw it at Linux World, probably about 2 years ago, erupted with, we need to virtualize, we need to virtualize, we need virtual machines. And it kind of caught me off guard when I saw that at the Linux World I was at, simply because, you know, you deal with the technology long enough and you figure, well, this is not really new technology. It's been around for a while, and God knows the predecessors to the logical predecessors to VMware and these things have been around on IBM mainframes, you know, since before I was born, for God's sakes. And, you figure, what's the rush? Well, what happened, you know, is that there was a coming together of an existing technology, but with a business plan which now made money for people using it. And it had to do with, in the case of, like, VMware and Xen and whatnot, there's a lot to be done with server consolidation, a lot to be done with server agility and all these other things, ways to reduce costs in a data center. So suddenly this technology, which is basically kind of old in theory, is now exciting and is the big go-to thing. And I think, the lesson that I get from this is that, you know, it's possible to have open formats and various things that are just kind of kicking around, and you think, well, you know, we use them, but they're never really going to gain steam. Well, the trick may be to find that niche somewhere in the business world where suddenly this rather, you know, stable technology becomes exciting from a business standpoint. In other words, someone can actually make some serious money by employing these things. And when it does happen, then I think you see a bang, kind of like we've seen in the virtualization world. So that would be an encouragement that I would have to people who are actually trying to figure the leverage point with whatever the technology is, if you can figure out a way that you know, the IT world can actually make money or save money in somewhat in obvious ways at times, that's where suddenly I think pet technologies can become actually mainstream technologies.
Cool. Alan, you still with us?
I'm still here.
Got any comments to add?
No, I'm pretty quiet tonight. Thank you.
You stink. A lot of good stuff going on. What distributions do you use there, Russ? What do you prefer?
That's an interesting one. It's almost embarrassing. The desktop that I have sitting in front of me as I speak is actually the last Mandrake that came out before it became Mandriva. I was always kind of a Mandrake bigot. And then when the Mandriva thing came out, I kind of took a pause. So actually, I've been just sort of hacking away on my existing desktop because, you know, push comes to shove, I'm not doing much noise software development these days, but I can still get stuff done. At other times, certainly any time I'm doing server-type stuff, it seems like more times than not it ends up being, if not Red Hat, then, you know, one of the Red Hat-ish distributions, you know, White Box or so forth. And like I said, it seems like most of the people around me who are not technophiles, I end up hooking them up with Xandros, which has done remarkably well in that area. I've got this strange little love relationship with IPCOP for firewalls. I think I breed them or something like this. I just seems like wherever I go, I leave this little trail of IPCOP firewalls behind me. So you can probably, you know, find where I've been. But anyone who hasn't played around with IPCOP, that is a sweet little firewall distribution. Nice little web pages and everything. It is really, really nice. Installs quickly, and it's got a lot of power to it. Really fun stuff. Another favorite, you know, is not Myth, you know, Myth TV boxes.
I've got
them sitting in my living room. Absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Of course, you know, now we've got the thing coming with HDTV, and you can't get they can't manufacture any Linux-compatible HDTV cards or something like this. It's been a while since I've been on this subject. But because of the whole DRM nonsense that's involved with it. So, you know, it's, just, it makes me ill is what it is. But Myth TV is superb for anyone who wants the convenience of a TiVo-like instrument, but wants some blood and guts underneath it all. Very nice Linux-based system. I'm trying to think what else I have kicking around. I think those are the main ones, anyway. That's most of them.
Cool. Is your family all using Linux?
Most of them, yeah. Actually, they have for a long time, most of them, despite the fact that there are no real technologists in my family except for me. exception of my brother's family, I should clarify that. But actually, I don't know what he's doing these days. Don't see him that often as far as software goes. But, you know, I originally started my wife and kids on Mandrake Cheaper's like 5.3 a long time ago. And it's amazing, you know, when people were saying Linux is difficult, Linux is hard. My family got used to working with Linux, and then when they had to switch over to Windows to do stuff, they start complaining about how hard Windows was. And it a lot of it has to do, when it comes to a desktop system, it's what you know is the baseline. And that's about the size of it. When I was in college, right after the Earth Surface cooled, we used to run an entire campus based on a PDP-1134A, for anyone who's old enough to remember the DEC PDP-11 series. Word processing, quote-unquote, was done with the editor known as TECO, T-E-C-O, and the formatter known as Runoff. And anyone who remembers these things knows that TECO is perhaps one of the most cryptic editors in the history of mankind. It's literally almost every keystroke is a command. It's just a wild thing. But we had secretaries running in TECO. You know, we had English students using TECO and Runoff, and Runoff, of course, being the markup language. You know, also somewhat cryptic in its own right, but these were what people got used to, and they did fine. And when you go to change, that's when the expense is, that's when people start bitching and moaning. And I was reading an article just recently about Vista, about how someone was saying, you know, the Office suite in Vista is so much better than the existing Windows Office suites. But they fully expect that businesses won't adopt it for another several years because they have to retrain. And that's the issue. It's not the fact that it isn't easy or better. It's the fact that something else is already there. And that's hard. One of the things I think we as people in the technology field miss is how hard it is for people to retrain. I remember being in a meeting once where, you know, we were talking about resumes or something, and one fellow brought up the fact that he organized in his office the training classes for people to go from Windows 95 to Windows 98. Now, anyone who actually remembers Windows 95 and Windows 98 knows that the difference between the two is that one ends in 5 and one ends in 8, and that's about the size of it. You know, I mean, it had the same basic look and feel. It had the same programs and hopefully just a couple less bugs in 98. And the thought, you know, from a technology standpoint, that anyone would have to train people to upgrade from, you know, and it wasn't even about making the upgrade. It was about using Office under 98 as opposed to using Office under 95 or whatever. You know, it seems trivial to those of us who make a living doing this stuff. But to the rest of the world, it's actually hard. It's actually work. And so I think a lot of the pressure about Linux desktop adoption and so forth has nothing to do with whether it's easy. It's just the fact that it's not identical to what's there. That's the hurdle when it comes to people who are not in the technology field.
Yeah. Now, are you going to be going to any of the festivals this year, or conventions?
Well, I'm speaking up at the Pseudo Linux World New York. What do they call it? The Open Source Summit, I think it is, February 14th and 15th, I believe, in New York City. I will probably be putting in to try to speak out at the West Coast, well, now the only extant Linux World Expo in the U.S. I tend to do that pretty regularly. Beyond that, I honestly don't know, because I find myself busy. And that sort of limits my ability to travel too much on more pleasurable tasks, because most of the time if I'm not there on business, I need to be at home dealing with something going on with my kids, either helping them fix their houses or helping my wife with my daughter's wedding preparations or whatever the hell. So I don't know. It's kind of the roundabout answer outside of those, outside of the Linux world events here in the U.S. I don't know.
Oh, that's cool. That is cool. Time is, oh wow, we're getting close to closing up time. I want to thank you, Russ, for coming on tonight. It's been great speaking with you.
It's been good talking to you fellas. Hope I haven't sucked all the air out of the room here.
No, really appreciate you coming on. We'd love it if you'd consider coming on, you know, again and more often even.
Well, we certainly can talk about it. Trying to get my schedule oriented these days is a trick, but I had a great time. It's been too dang long, frankly, since I had a chance to chew people's ears off in public. So I thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, Russ. We really appreciate it.
You're always welcome, Russ.
Thank you.
Now, you other three losers I don't care about.
You never care about us, Dan.
Do you guys have anything you want to add?
I got the new blog up and running. You guys want to check it out?
Oh, it's a new URL and everything now?
No, the URL's the same. It's on a different box, all new versions of software, and the only thing that'll change probably is maybe the RSS feed will change.
Okay. And what are you running on now?
I put it on my AMD system that Dan thinks I'm going to sell in a month from now.
Oh, you got the new system.
Yeah.
It'll be a month and a half.
A month and a half. I bumped it up to 2 gig, and it's running with a RAID card with two serial ATA drives. And it's pretty sweet. I installed Ubuntu server install. And it's pretty damn easy, man. It's real nice.
Isn't that nice? That new Ubuntu server, that is really nice to install, man.
It is. I'm pretty impressed.
I was digging it. That getting a LAMP installation running using that was, yeah, good Lord, it was a piece of cake, you know? The only thing that really irritated me is it didn't have Secure Shell installed by default. Thought that was kind of
Yeah.
odd.
Yeah, no Secure Shell by default, which is kind of odd. I tell you what, though, the RAID card was really easy to set up. It has its own BIOS, like, you know, like the old SCSI cards. And, you know, the first time you boot it up, you go into the BIOS and you select, you know, whatever RAID setup you want to do. You know, I'm doing a RAID 1 with two drives. You know, I toggle the primary, I flag the mirror, and that's it. You know, the OS only sees it as one drive, and it works great. Now, if one fails, the other drive will fail over, you know, and it'll send you a notification letting you know that there was a problem with the primary and that it switched over to the backup. It's fast as hell. And the other thing I noticed is the drives are very quiet.
That's nice.
Now, what are you going to do about your myth box?
Well, the blog server is also going to be my back end for Myth. And, I'm looking to do high definition TV. I've been reading up on that stuff. And, the workstation that I have now, I don't think it has processor speed enough to do high def playback. It sounds like you need at least maybe, I don't know, a Pentium 4 or better. Celeron's probably not going to cut it. And a high-definition capture card is optional, dependent upon how you're capturing it. For instance, if you have a, like the Motorola 6200
high-def cable boxes, you can capture the video signal directly via FireWire and also control the channel selection through the FireWire. You don't even need a capture card. But not everybody has that cable box. So if you're doing over-the-air, you're going to have to get a high-def capture card like the HD 5000 or the, AirDevast card. Those are pretty cheap. Those you can get for like $100 new, and like if you go like on eBay, you can get them anywhere between, you know, $50-$60 used.
That's nice.
But yeah, I definitely think maybe we could do a myth install fest at some point in the future.
You know what's funny? Is Russ still on? Are you still on, Russ?
Yeah, I'm here.
I am still using... Everybody's running Myth, right? Like a patent. You're not running Myth yet, are you, Dan?
No, I hope to be soon.
TiVo. Pat and Alan are running Myth. And you know what I'm doing? I'm still running a bastardized version of that script that you had published on your website.
God.
Like, I keep tweaking it, you know, for, you know, when it changed from the video client 1 to 2 and stuff like that. And I've just been tweaking it along and going along with it. It runs just fine, you know. But I think it's funny.
Well, you like pain, I guess. I mean, I ran that for quite a while, and it was great fun. But I'll tell you, when I finally saw, I mean, at the time that I put together that box and then wrote that little write-up on my website, you know, Myth TV was kind of a concept more than it was anything usable and so forth. But like a year or two later, I looked at what was done, and I thought, oh, man, this puts me to shame. And I just sort of did a destruction on that box. I actually am sitting here in the corner in my mayoral box, but both of the new Myth TV box, and I have not looked back. One of the things, though, that was kind of funny was, I forget the name of the book exactly, but one of the hardware hacking books, they referenced that design that I did, quote-unquote design, in there as one of the little chapter projects or whatever, and they asked, you know, do you mind if we include it? It's like, sure. I don't know why, so it is so old at this point, but, you know, immortalized.
A couple of little tweaks for, like, a different codec that I'm using, and you know, the different video clients and stuff like that. You know, I had to adjust it between V4L and V4L2. And wow. I changed one of the codecs to the newer DivX or something like that. And it's just been, you know, it's just a script that I keep kicking around on my computer and works really good.
Yeah.
And I can use that without having to dedicate a whole box to Myth. That's even better.
That's cool. That's wild.
Just haven't done it yet.
Well, I'll tell you, one nice thing, Zaptuit, Myth uses, nice little service. That makes a big difference to me personally, but that's cool.
Yeah, there's companies now that actually sell pre-built Myth TV boxes. There's the Dragon company that's somewhat involved with Cecil Watson from the Not Myth Project. And there's also another company, I forget the name of it, but they're also building Myth TV boxes too. I guess to me, you know, I look at what these guys are doing, I'm saying, yeah, that's pretty cool. But for them to really become a viable business, I think they kind of have to come down in price than what they're offering. It's hard to do because they're basically just getting parts and putting them together, you know.
Right.
For it to be really a business that someone could really push, I think they would have to sell them for like maybe $350 tops, which is pretty cheap, you know.
Right.
The cheapest box I've seen is about $500. You know,
oh, wow.
I look at that and I say I could do it for $350.
Yeah, but I guess they're trying to make money, which
it's
fine.
Cool that they're trying, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you going to do? Yeah, I want to build my...
You going to wrap it up?
Yeah. Maybe some Frapper shout-outs, Pat? Talk about upcoming guests?
Oh, we haven't done those. Haven't done those in a while.
No, we haven't.
Who do we got? I think we have a few from since last time. Let's see. Hold on a sec. We've got Silver Ghost from Eugene, Oregon. We've got X Gizmo from Athens, Tennessee. We've got Albert Measure from the Netherlands. And we've got David G from Melbourne, Australia. And Mike from Thousand Oaks, California. And I think that's it. Upcoming guests. I think next week we're doing, I think just us next week, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just check the calendar real quick. Who do we got? Who do we got? Yeah, it's just us next week. In the upcoming weeks, we got Will Backman from BSD Talk podcast coming on. And also in a few weeks, we got JTS Moore, the director of Revolution OS documentary, which is a really cool movie if anyone hasn't seen it. I highly recommend it. Check that out. It's been a few years since that came out. You guys remember when that came out? 2000, maybe? 2001?
Yeah.
I still have it, yep. Yeah, it's good. It shows a lot of the early stuff. Talks about the history of Linux and, you know, the GNU Foundation and free software and open source, and talks to everybody.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's good stuff. Good stuff.
What are you going to do? All right.
So, Dan, we're going to play us out?
Yeah, we'll play us out.
We're going to play a song from that group, Mandrake Group, which is a Swedish hard rock metal band. The song is called The Desert Kings, I do believe. It's a pretty rocking song.
Yeah, it would be nice if I waited until you were done talking. Sorry. I'm sorry.
That's basically it. So all right. We'll see everybody we'll see everybody next week.
Thank you, everybody.
Russ, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for listening.
All right.
Thank
Take
you,
care.
Russ.
All right, everybody. Thanks again, Russ, for coming on. And thanks, everybody, for joining us on 177. Catch us next week for 178. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Does your computer crash? Are you aggravated with computer viruses and spyware? Are you looking for an alternative to Microsoft Vista? Whether you're an expert or have only just heard of Linux, here's your chance to learn more at the Southern California Linux Expo. You'll meet users of all skill levels and organizations who will show you what open source software can do for you at home or at work. The Expo has speakers who will discuss various hot topics in open source software, and this year we've even added beginner sessions to especially help those of you who are just starting out. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 10th and 11th, 2007, at the Westin Hotel at Los Angeles International Airport. For more information or to register, please visit www.socallinuxexpo.com. Use promo code CAST, C-A-S-T, for 40% off your registration. We'll see you there.
I am man, hear me roar. The number's too big to ignore. And I'm way too hungry to settle for chick food. 'Cause my stomach's starting to growl. And I'm going on the prowl for a Texas double whopper. Man, that's good. Oh, yes, I'm a guy. I'll admit I've been fed quiche. Way tofu, bye-bye. Now it's for Whopper Beef I reach. I will eat this meat till my innie turns into an owie. I am starved. I am incorrigible. And I need to stop a big burger, beef, bacon, jalapeno, good thing down. Yeah! I am hungry.
Texas Double Whopper. Eat like a man, man.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.